International African Revolution.
Seems to know I'm gone. Home is where the hatred is. Home is filled with pain. And it may not be such a bad idea if I never went home again. Stand as far away from me as you can and ask me why. Beats, close your eyes and watch me die. You keep saying kick it, quit it, Lord, but did you ever try to turn your sick soul inside out so that the world can watch you die? It's where I live inside, white powder dreams. Home was once an empty vacuum that's filled now with my silent screams. Home is where the needle marks try to heal my broken heart. It might not be such a bad idea if I never went home again. Stand as far away from me as you can and ask me why. Hang on to your rosary beads, close your eyes, watch me die. You keep saying kick it, quit it, Lord, but did you ever try to turn your sick soul inside out so that the world can watch you die, can watch you die, watch you die, watch you die? You say kick it, you keep saying quit it.
Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Jalali, a.k.a. Norman Otis Richmond, speaking to you from the not-so-great white north. I am your bluesologist, and we kicked off today's show with Esther Phillips, but let us thank a few people before we get into talking about, before we start talking about Esther Phillips. But we would like to thank Chairman Mali Sotella and Archie Shep, two young men from Florida, who gave us the show. Omali Ishitella, the chair of the African People Socialist Party and African International Socialist International, gave me the space to do diasporic music, and Archie Shep gave me the concept of diasporic music, music made in the West, but not of the West, but we are of Africa, but we are not in Africa, so we are very cognizant of that. And we have some great shows on Uhuru Radio, many great shows. We have Straight from the Streets with A.J. Ali. We have O'Malley Ishatella Speaks. We have Africa Live with Didon Sankara. We have Reparations in Action with Penny Hess. We have Revolutionary Health and Fitness with John Thomas. Ron Bob Simple is on. He's so nice, he comes on twice. That's not really true, because he really comes on three times. Check him out tonight on Golden Sunday Sounds tonight, and also check him on Caribbean Forum, and he also does a African History Month show, Great Moments in African History. Also, check out Glenn Ford and Nellie Bailey on the Black Agenda Report, and check out the report from Africans in Sweden and throughout Europe. We are everywhere. And we kick the show off with the music of the great Esther Phillips. And Esther Phillips was, she made her mark in Los Angeles, California. But she was born in Galveston, Texas. In Galveston, Texas, many of the Africans came from Angola to Galveston, Texas. And also Galveston, Texas is the birthplace of a young man who many people might know. His name was Barry White. He also came to Los Angeles. And Galveston, Texas was also the birthplace of a young man who people might know a little bit about. He could box a little bit. His name was Jack Johnson. And Jack Johnson lived in Mexico, and he spent some time in Russia. He used to hang out with Rasputin. Jack Johnson is, we should do a whole show on that young man. But we're going to be speaking with Bev Smith. Bev Smith is going to be on our show, and Bev Smith is a great talk show host and used to be on BET and many, many stations. But Bev Smith will be on shortly. And also, we're going to be speaking to a young man by the name of Dar Malik El Bey, a.k.a. Ranji Southern, who is a young man who I've known for most of my life. We're going to be talking about Marvin Gaye and our encounter with Marvin Gaye. And also, I guess the big news is the lawsuit that his family won against those two gentlemen. And I don't even want to mention their names, but we're going to talk about them. But right now we want to play some. We're this is International Women's Month, and we're paying tribute to women. And we're also looking at the music of Gil Scott-Heron. Gil Scott-Heron, Heron's music was recorded by a number of sisters, and we heard Esther Phillips and do "Home Is Where the Hatred Is." Of course, was a great song by Gil Scott-Heron, and we're going to continue with some more music from Gil Scott-Heron from some sisters, and Diasporic Music will be black.
Wawanko, the rhythm of rebirth and rejuvenation.
Living in a bottle. In a bottle.
You see that black boy over there running scared? He's not five and he drink full time, and now he's living in a bottle. You see that black boy over there running scared? His old man got a problem, and it's a bad one. He done pawned off damn near everything. His old woman's wedding ring for a bottle. Don't you think? Time after time, people in the bottle.
Push is gonna be live.
Nanga Death to all of our listeners in Senegal, Gambia, and Mauritania. Nanga Death is Wolof. Greetings in Wolof, and we are paying tribute to this International Women's Month. And we are playing some music by sisters that did music from Gil Scott-Heron. We just heard LaBelle, Gary LaBelle, Sarah Dash, and Nona Hendrix. They did something in the air, Revolution. The Revolution will not be televised. And we also heard The Bottle by Mesa. The Bottle is a classic Gil Scott-Heron record. Gil Scott-Heron says that he was really taught by his grandmother, who was in Jackson, Tennessee, but she was born in Alabama. And Gil's father, of course, was Gil Scott, was a great soccer player. He was the first black person to play professional soccer. He was in Scotland, and there was an article about him in the 1948 Ebony magazine, but Gil Scott-Heron is was a great, great, great writer and composer, and wrote a lot of songs that women recorded. And we are going to be speaking with Bev Smith in a few moments. But first, we are going to listen to some music from LaDisa and Jill Scott. We wanted to hear something called Round Midnight. And also, Good Morning Heartache by Jill Scott. This was recommended by Bev Smith. She wanted to hear that. So let us listen to LaDisa and Jill Scott.
Die, do bit lee, zoobit do, zidoot lee, do bit die, zidoot be, zoobit do. Zai, do bit dee, do bit do. She do lee, do bit die, she do lee, do bit do.
when old midnight comes around. Memories always start around midnight. My heart is still with you, and old midnight knows it too. When some girl we had needs mending, doesn't mean that our love is ending. Darling, I need you. Lately, I find you're out of my arms and out of my mind. Ooh, let our love take flight some midnight, roll midnight.
You're here to stay. It seems I met you when my love went away. Now every day I start by saying to you, good morning, heartache, what's new? Stop hurting me now. Sunday blues. Look what you did to me. Yeah, 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 yes. Good morning, heartache. Here we go again. Good morning, heartache. You're the one who knew me when. I might as well get used to you hanging around. Good morning, heartache. Good morning, heartache. Good morning, Sid. Just know if you're gonna stay. Heartache, you're gonna have to get a job. See, mama's got bills to pay. Okay, okay. Good morning. Good morning. Good morning. Get my money, heartache. Good morning. Good, 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 good. It'll be all good now. Hey. Open the blinds. Open the blinds. Open the blinds. You won't do that, will you, heartache? You don't want me to see the sunshine.
Jill Scott, come on. I gotta recover from that heartache. My goodness.
Uhuru, I am Mayembe Malaika. I support Burning Spear Media and Norman Otis Richmond. Will you? Burning Spear Media keeps alive African culture from North America, the Caribbean, Africa, and the world. We have not forgotten Patrice Emery Lumumba, Joseph Okito, and Maurice Mbolo. Burning Spear Media keeps them alive. Uhuru News and Radio connects African people worldwide. Burning Spear Media is owned and controlled by the African working class. Yes, bless you.
You are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. We just heard from Jill Scott, Good Morning, Heartache. and Round Midnight by La Disa. And Round Midnight, of course, is from the pen of Thelonious Monk. And joining us on the phone from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Bev Smith. She currently hosts the Bev Smith Show each weeknight from 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. Eastern on the Empowerment Radio Network. And she also has been named the Media Maker by the History Makers. And Bev Smith is a longtime talk show host, and I remember listening to Ms. Smith on all sorts of forums, including BET. And it's been a while since you and I spoke, Ms. Smith. How have you been?
Well, I'm fine. What do I say? Happy New Year, Happy Kwanzaa, happy. It's been about maybe 5 or 6 years.
6 years, yes, ma'am. Yeah, last time I spoke to you, I was on a station called CKLN, and they ran us off of air up here. We were a little bit too progressive for them, and they chased us off the radio. But the last time we spoke, we were heard all over Canada. We were actually on the dial. We were not in that.
Yeah, that's good. Well, it's good to hear from you. I'm just so honored that you called and wanted to talk about our new efforts and the things that we've been doing. And you know what they say about African Americans? We're like that energized bunny. We just keep ticking. Even when we take a leak, we keep on ticking. Can you feel me? We just keep on ticking.
I guess the first thing I wanted to ask you, what are your thoughts on International Women's Month now? You know, we have, African women from, going all the way back to Queen Nzinga and Yaa Santawa and Harriet Tubman. I mean, we have African women have made contributions from North America, from Caribbean and Africa. And, of course, African people that we were scattered all over the world. What are your thoughts on International Women's Month? That's the first thing I want to ask you.
Well, I think that the contributions of African-American women are downplayed, because if you really want to talk about African women, we can go back to the mother of Jesus. If you want to talk about, for us, who are the descendants of Eve, we can go back to Eve, the first one that they have claimed is the mother of all civilization. So I personally believe that we do not look at the contributions of women, that we don't look at them in the 17th century, the 18th century, the 19th century, or the 21st century. We just don't look at that when we celebrate. The majority of people that are celebrated as women are white or European. And I think that there ought to be, and I really do, I think that there ought to be extra efforts, which we're doing on our show, to highlight. But Black History is something that we talk about every day, so we just don't use February or the month of March. We highlight the contributions of African women wherever they are every day, 365 every day. So I personally don't see an outpouring of information about women of African descent in America. I mean, when's the last time you heard, unless you did it yourself, about the woman who did the ironing board or the straightening comb? Or one of the wealthiest women in America.
Madam C.J. Walker?
Madam C.J. Walker. When's the last time you heard about... Yes, we hear about Harriet Tubman, but rarely do we hear about Sojourner Truth. Who mentions Nikki Giovanni? Do you hear her name? Not too often. Eleanor Holmes Norton? Not too often. Barbara Jordan? Once in a while. But I personally don't think that we pay enough attention, and that's why we go out of our way to salute the contributions of African women around the world, and in particular, we concentrate on this place called America.
Now, Madam C.J. Walker, I guess I'm slightly biased, because Madam C.J. Walker was born in Louisiana, the same place I was born in, but she contributed. A lot of people don't realize it. Madam C.J. Walker used to give a lot of money to the Universal Negro Improvement Associations and African Communities League, the Marcus Garvey's movement, and she was a mover and shaker. I mean, a lot of people get caught up on the fact that she did the straightening comb, or, you know, she's known for the straightening.
She had a bang.
Comb and all that, but she did a lot of things to help the struggle for African people.
And she had a bank. She had lending institutions because we could not go to banks and get money. So you went to Madam C.J. Walker. She invested in the business of a lot of not only African women. I'm talking about people who ironed for a living. She helped them. Or someone who taught for a living and started a school. Her contributions have never really been discovered. Like, I think, a woman that I'm very, very fond of and would like to believe was a mentor was Fannie Lou Hamer and C. Dolores Tucker. You don't hear their names either.
No.
And I was pleased to see that the post office in America did a stamp for Shirley Chisholm, but whoever the artist was, they need to go back to the drawing board. But I was pleased to see that they have a stamp out for her.
Right.
She doesn't get mentioned either. She really was the first black woman to run for the presidency of the United States.
Yeah, Shirley Chisholm had a Guyanese and Barbadian background. I think she was born in the U.S., but her people's roots are from Africa by way of the Caribbean, like the rest. Like
that's exactly right. She's Caribbean. Yeah, she's
right.
Caribbean descent. I had the honor of meeting her, interviewing her on numerous occasions, and then of course we really don't hear the full story about Mrs. Rosa Parks. To have her and Artis Lane, who did the very famous image of her on the bus. I'm looking at it right now in my home. In my home, I did a reception for them. And the story that is told is, of course, when she was on the bus, but you never hear about the work that she did before that. And she and her husband, Raymond, who paid terribly for standing up and being counted and get involved, he lost his job. They were involved in the struggle long before America found out who they were.
That's right. Oh yeah, that's true. Now
so
you know you mentioned Fannie Lou Hamer, and you know I found out that Fannie Lou Hamer was buried, I think, in a place called Mount Bayou, Mississippi, which was an all-black town. And I spoke to Elsie Cook a couple of weeks ago, Sam Cook's brother, and he said that his grandfather, they owned his grandmother's, his mother's father, which was L.C. and Sam Cook's grandfather, owned part of that town. You know, Mount Bayou, that's where Fannie Lou Hamer was buried.
Was
but,
born. Was she born
Mount
there,
Bayou,
Norman?
She was born
was
in Mississippi. She's buried, pardon me, in Mount Bayou, but she was born in another part of
Mississippi.
But I'm getting all mixed up because I follow Fannie Lou Hamer so much. I'm supposed to know where she was born right off the top of my head, but she was buried in this town, which was an all black town in Mississippi.
I'm always reminded of her at the convention. And
the
her
Democratic
standing
Party convention. Yes, ma'am.
To be right. Recognized. I mean, it took a lot of strength. And I will always believe that because she had this strength and because she was able to stand up for voting, I believe that that's what contributed to her death, because they beat her almost unto death with no regard for her being a woman, her age, or her rights as a human being. And she suffered for a long, long time as a result of that beating. I am convinced they killed her. She may have died years later, but I'm convinced they killed her. But she was a powerful, powerful woman. Just a sweet woman who liked to hug folks.
Well, you know, someone mentioned that same point last night She got, as a result of that beating, she died premature. She could have lived longer, but because she died because of that particular beating.
Yes, absolutely.
Which a lot of people believe, and I believe as well. But I wanted to talk to you about Pittsburgh. Now, Pittsburgh is a spot. I used to come through Pittsburgh every once in a while, but I know that Pittsburgh produced Blue Haina, as that's Art Blakey, Billy Eckstein, George Benson. I think Phyllis Hyman was born in Pittsburgh. Also, Pittsburgh was where Doc Ellis, who was from my hometown, pitched a no-hitter on LSD. And Pittsburgh was the home of a place where one of my favorite baseball players of all time, Roberto Clemente from Puerto Rico, I think he guys won the World Series one year. But
well, don't forget Ahmad Jamal and Dakota State.
Ah, cool. I'm sorry. Yeah, Ahmad Jamal, forget. The pianist. And who else?
Yeah. Earl Father Hines.
My God, the pianist Earl Father Hines, and I can't miss you. I can't. How can I forget Earl Father Hines? Yeah.
Yeah, I developed a scholarship for him in the 70s for people, young people who wanted to go to school. It has since defunct. When I left town, they let it just go. But the truth of the matter is, we were able to provide music lessons for a lot of children who wanted to study the piano just with that Earl Father Hines scholarship.
Mm-hmm. So what is in the water in Pittsburgh that produced that made you guys produce people like that?
Well, I'm here thinking not only that, but you had an African-American who worked with Jonas Salk and who many believed as a lab technician was one of the developers of the Salk vaccine for polio. And there were five lab technicians. One of them was Dr. Lamar Cato working with him at the time. We have that. We have Maurice Holmes, who during the late 80s and early 90s was in charge of all new developments at IBM, and he had a $200 million budget, an African-American who graduated from my high school. We have the first black man to own a national utility company, Earl Davis, Dr. Earl Davis. He no longer owns it. He's moved out of that area and retired, but he owned the first black energy company in the country. I went to school with him. So there are tons and tons and tons of athletes and educators and all kinds of things like that that came out of the Pittsburgh community. No, not in the water, because if it was in the water, we'd be fixed now. Pitt University said we are as racist as the whole state of Mississippi, and I agree with them. And when I moved back to Pittsburgh from the Washington, Maryland, D.C. area to take care of my parents, I thought I had stepped into a time zone. This is a racist, sexist town, and it needs work, and that's what we're trying to do. It really needs work. We just inaugurated a show. I do a national show, which you spoke about. Thank you for mentioning that. And I'm syndicating myself, which is a whole new experience and will definitely be in the book, Talking While Black. But I also have been involved in trying to make sure that we re-educate people to the power of their vote. And we are totally polarized in this community, and I'm not talking about black and white and everything in between. I'm talking about blacks. If we are an example of what's going on in the world today where blacks are concerned, we have a lot of work to do, Norman. A lot of work.
Is it a class situation where the various bourgeois, the bougie blacks and the wannabe bougie blacks versus the working class blacks?
That's part of the problem. And we have to say it because it's time for the truth, and everyone deserves to hear the truth. The truth must be told, and everyone deserves to hear. So here's the truth. The truth is we are suffering from delayed slave syndrome. In a world where 10 years ago Howard University's pom-pom girls held up a brown paper bag 10 years ago and said, if you're darker than this, you can't be on. If you wear weave, you can't be on. If you wear dreadlocks, you can't be on. I don't know what that has to do with jumping and shouting and shaking pom-poms, but it's a part of our self-hatred, so that's one of them. The political element in this city, the mayor, the council people, the Pittsburgh public school system, all have contributed to the polarization through a series of behaviors, closing down of schools, not updating the equipment. Sounds like I'm talking about the 60s and the 50s. I'm talking about through the year 2000 to this very date. We have a problem. Of course, we have police brutality here. You read about the cases. And a very, very famous coroner, who happens to be a personal friend of mine, Cyril Weck, Dr. Cyril Weck, has encountered threats against his life and everything else. We're talking about the racism within the police department and the murders, he called it what it was, of several people, and the injuries of several people. Jordan Marsh comes to mind because I am very, very connected to him and his mom. This was a boy who was an A student, went to the school for the performing arts, president of his high school, getting ready to graduate from the school for the performing arts, an A student, and had a full scholarship. He was leaving his house to go to his grandmother's house. He stayed with his grandmother every night. I'm talking maybe 7 doors away. Oh, let's give him 10 doors away. Sitting in the community in unmarked cars, two white men who looked like they were wrestlers for WrestleMania. Unmarked car, not in uniform. They yelled at him. He started to run. He thought they were drug dealers. They grabbed him and beat him, unbelievable, and pulled his dreadlocks out. And if you were to see him, when his mother found out where he was and went to the hospital, his mother and his grandmother went to the jail to get him because they wouldn't let him be seen. She didn't recognize his son, her own son. That's how badly he had been beaten. And another boy, Leon Ford, last year was shot. That case has gone national. So Pittsburgh is a microcosm of what's happening. So, yes, there is the bourgeoisie. Yes, there is the light versus the dark. Yes, there is the undereducated against the educated. But there also is a lack of commitment to our ethnic group. We are the only ethnic group in America. I don't say race, because there's only one race. And that's the human race, although we have some people who look human, like human beings, but they're masquerading. They're just some beings. But you got it. Good. I'm glad you got that. Just beings masquerading as humans. I think that we are back. I think we're in worse shape than we were 20 years ago, 30 years ago, or 40 years ago, because we have opted for other people's culture and not hung on to the culture or passed it on to the young people that we're reading about today. And I hear this every day. Why didn't someone tell us? Why didn't someone tell us? Why do we have to listen to your show, Miss Bev, to hear everything? Why didn't we learn this? And I say, go ask your mama and your daddy, okay? Because, Norman, you know, in our communities when we came up, everyone in the community knew who graduated from college. Everybody in the community probably put a couple of dollars in an envelope when you graduated from high school. Or maybe that wasn't that kind of a community. Maybe you had a community where everybody was on the same level, but if someone died in your family, you left your door open so the neighbors could go in and out and help you. We've moved away from that as we tried to blend in, to merge with other people's culture. We're the only ethnic group in America allow people to dictate how our culture, and I shouldn't say culture because we are cultures. The African continent has over 55 countries, and that isn't all the developed land. And so,
well, you know, I don't want to cut you, but I was born in Louisiana, and I left. My mother told me I was conceived in Los Angeles. I was born in Los Angeles. And the people that made up Los Angeles, California at that time were from Louisiana, Texas, Mississippi, Oklahoma, basically. And it was like you're basically saying, we looked after one another. I had an uncle who my grandfather had 20 children, and had 61 first cousins. And one of my uncles, his pictures on Facebook, if you go to Facebook, my grandfather, my uncle, their pictures up there. But my uncle, the one the pictures is up there, he used to go back and basically recruit from Louisiana, bring people out, and they worked in a plant. And we looked after one another. That's true. And I went back to California. It's been about 8 months, a year ago, and it's completely different. Skid Row is nothing but us in Los Angeles.
Well, I think when we look at where we came from, we all migrated from the South, really. That's where we were dumped, and we migrated our way through. And I think wherever we went, we carried this idea that white was better. Now, I'm not talking about speaking English, because we've always been bilingual. We had colloquialism. We created the bebop, idiom of talking. Now we have the hip-hop idiom, the rhythm of the words. But we also spoke English. And that is an accomplishment that is never discussed, because our enslavers were Spanish and English and French.
Dutch.
And we had a Dutch and German. We never talked about German. And what we did was we learned their language, particularly the Spanish conquerors. We learned their language. So we were able to hang on to our own tongue, which was outlawed, just like they did Native Americans. They cut out the tongue. And when I mean cut out tongue, I mean the language, tongue in the English as in England version, tongue as in the biblical translated Elizabethan language. It means the way you talk. And they cut that out. We were not allowed, as Alex Haley pointed out in Roots, we were not allowed to carry our names. But in the olden days, we never forgot our names, because that was passed on. We have no more griots. We have no more people, and I'm generalizing, because every community has someone who says, like you are, Norman, I'm not going to let nobody turn me around. I am that
well,
I am.
Let me say this, because we only have a few more minutes left with my... One of the things I could never figure out is my grandmother, on my mother's side, her two names were Ola Me. Those are Yoruba names, and I could always, you know, and she looked like she was uncut. I mean, I don't think anything hit the truck. You know, she was 100%. But you know, that was one of the things that you know, we lost all of that. But I guess you know, that's one of the things that I was very proud of, the fact when I found out. I said, you know, Mama Ola, yeah, she kept that name, you know, that Yoruba thing happening.
We could keep any name. My brother, tracing our roots, because my father's grandfather was Irish. He married a woman who was Native American and African. And we wanted to know about the great race riot between the Irish and the blacks in New York, and how it was
deliberate. Right.
And so what we learned is that if I say you happy St. Patrick's Day, you might have some Irish in you. What is a black Irishman? That's a negative term. We should not use that. That was always used as a negative term. And so, like Blackfoot Indians, it was always used as a negative term. And so what we learned is that wherever we went, we left our mark. Can you say the transistor? Can you say the engine in the car? Can you say starter? So we have to celebrate the strength of who we are, and that message has to be given through our ethnic pride, and we don't have that. In my opinion, Norman.
Mm-hmm. So we only have a few minutes left, and I basically wanted you to let people know how they can listen to you, and I think you're working on a book about your life, I hope.
I'm working on two books, actually three, and I have one almost totally completed. And it's a book called, I call it A Spiritual Mystery. It's a book called Interview with Jesus, and it's about a black talk show host who God picks to interview Jesus on his return to the world. The second book is my book, Talking While Black, and I tell the story of being shot at and fired because I didn't uninvite Louis Farrakhan. I tell everything. I don't miss a cue. So that will be probably out next year. And then the final one is A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to Success. And that is a book about what I'm learning along the way about success. Most black people and most people in the world, we believe that success is money. And we believe that we are not successful because most of us don't have any money, okay? We're living, we're existing, but we don't have any money. Success is more than money. And so I take people through my journey to understand what success was, because when people used to ask me, and I teach and speak around the country and outside of the country, especially in the Caribbean, they pay me to come there, and I'm happy about it because I get a vacation and I get to meet new friends. And what we haven't been able to determine, in my mind, is how great we are. I'm just going to cut to the chase because you don't have much time. I wish that my people are all human people, but my people are African people. I call myself an African in America because that's what I am. I am African American, but I'm an African in America. Now, I may not be able to tell you where I come from, but I'm an African in America. I may be mixed with other cells.
But you're still an African in America. I agree completely.
But the DNA for all human life came out of Africa. That's not Bill Smith talking. You know, black folks believe white ice is better. White ice is colder. So this is a white man, men. These are white folks, women, who looked genetically at the first and oldest bones and called her Eve. Who looked genetically, this is the latest thing, and said, and came out with reports that the DNA in that person in Africa is in every ethnic group in the world. And if you read Dr. Frances Cress Welsing's Cress Theory, where she almost did not get her PhD from a black school, Howard University, because she talked about the beginning of racism out of Africa, when black women gave birth to lighter children. You know, when a black woman has a baby, she doesn't know what color that baby's coming out to be. Can I get a witness? So
amen. There are many amen. Things. Amen.
Thank you. So there are many things that we must do. If black people, just wherever they are in the planet, whether it's Canada, whether it's Mississippi, where it's Virginia and Arkansas, where my family's roots are on both sides of the family, whether it's Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where I am now, I am connected to you. I'm an honorary Bahamian. I am connected. I am connected because I can go, come to Canada, which I do, and I love Montreal's Carnival. I can come there, and I can look at people, and I think, is that Aunt Lou? That looks like Aunt Lou. We are connected, and out of us came everything. If we just started there, a young black man wouldn't be able to pick up a gun and shoot another black man because he would know what he knows that he knows. But we don't tell
Yes, ma'am. And with that, I'm going to have to bring you – I'd like to bring you back, but I'd like to continue this dialogue, and I really appreciate you coming on Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. And I see you still have the – Bill Smith is still full of fire.
I wish I could. My doctor told me the other day, when are you going to quit all of this? And I said, when God calls me home, this is a God's assignment. Because you and I both know we don't get paid. We don't get paid. And for some reason, because we may not be a person who stars on Empire or Scandal or How to Kill, How to Commit a Murder. And because we're not a name, and I consider myself just a working woman, we may not get the kind of salaries or opportunities of others, but we do have a God assignment, and that God assignment is to lift our people up, the original people. And so I'll be
yes, ma'am. But this computer's getting ready to run out, so I'm gonna have to cut you loose, and we'll bring you back definitely.
I'll be glad to come back. You call me anytime. You know we're sisters and brothers. We're connected. You just call me.
All right, and I've been listening to Bev Smith and Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio continues.
You're listening to UhuruRadio.com, voice of the International African Revolution.
Uhuru. I am the Real Sun, and I'm here to stand in solidarity and support Burning Spear Media. Burning Spear Media keeps alive African culture from North America, the Caribbean, Africa, and the world. We have not forgotten about the Bandung Conference of 1955, where leaders of African and Asian nations came together to stand in solidarity against colonial oppression. Burning Spear Media makes it possible to keep memories like these alive by honoring history and remembering legacy. It is owned and controlled by the Black working class, and it is one of the oldest newspapers to be in continuous publications since the civil rights movements of the 1960s. Leaders and organizations all over the world have been crushed for standing up for the voice, power, and rights of Black people all over the world. And yet, Burning Spear Media lives on. I support Burning Spear Media and Uhuru News and Radio, which connects African people all over the world. Will you?
Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, speaking to you from Toronto, Canada. We just spoke with Bev Smith. And we're getting ready to take a look at Marvin Gaye. Now, Marvin Gaye is in Marvin Gaye's family is in a lawsuit with two gentlemen. And I really don't even want to mention their names. You know who I'm talking about the song Blurred Lines. The understanding that they're getting ready to, I've heard mixed reports that they were going to sue these two gentlemen once again for taking this song Ain't That Peculiar, which we just played. Now, Ain't That Peculiar, some people have said that is based on that, you know, that the guy took Happy came from Ain't That Peculiar. I read one report that there was going to be a lawsuit against this gentleman for taking Ain't That Peculiar, which became Happy. I don't know how true that is, because I read a report that's not necessarily the truth. But Ain't That Peculiar, when I was living in Los Angeles, California, and I used to go to Temple Number 27, and the minister at that time was a young man by the name of John Shabazz, who's still in the land of the living. His name is Abdul Allah Muhammad. And he used to preach, or his sermon, one of his sermons was called Ain't That Peculiar. He took Marvin Gaye's, took this particular song, You Do Me Wrong, But Still I'm Crazy About You, Stay Away Too Long, blah, 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 Ain't That Peculiar. And he would talk about, he said that Marvin was singing about so-called Negro, but I remember that song. I remember that song. Now we want to continue. We're going to be speaking with Dar Malik LB at the bottom of the hour. But I remember Marvin Gaye had a big fight with his first wife. His first wife was Berry Gordy's sister, Anna Gaye. And they had a big, big, big fight. And he basically did an album and dedicated, or all of the royalties went to her for this particular album. And before that, Charles Mingus did the same thing. He did the same thing. He did an album in Toronto with Charlie Parker, Max Roach, Bud Powell, and it was Max, Dizzy, Charlie Parker. It was an album that was recorded at the Matthew Hall in Toronto. And Mingus gave the profits to his wife, and she was the reward to him. So Marvin Gaye basically did the same thing later. But the album was called Hear My Dear, and let's listen to Marvin Gaye and Hear My Dear, Met a Little Girl.
I guess I'll have to say this album is dedicated to you. Although perhaps I may not be happy, this is what you want. I've conceded. All that makes you happy, there's a lot of truth in it, baby. I don't think I'll have
any regrets, baby. Things didn't have to be the way they was, baby. You don't have the right to use a son of mine. Keep me in line. One thing I can't do without is the boy God gave to both of us. I'm so happy for the son of mine. So here it is. I hope you enjoy. Reminisce. Be happy. Think about the kisses, the joy. But there were those other moments too. The times that were cloudy and gray. Bad. Ah. As you taught me, that was life. May love ever possess you. May peace come into your life. May you always think of me the way I was. I was your baby. This is what you wanted. Here, dear. My dear. Here it is. Go wrong.
I wonder today if you're a friend of mine. Done some crying, woman. You have caused my tears to flow. Cry, do you cry about me? Do you ever think about the kind of love?
Are listening to Diasporic Music on Kahuna Radio. My name is Jalali, speaking to you from Toronto, Canada. We were listening to the music of Marvin Gaye here, my dear, and I met a little girl, and we had talked about playing Ain't That Peculiar, and we made a mistake, and we didn't play Ain't That Peculiar, but we talked about Ain't That Peculiar, which was a sermon that Minister John Shabazz, who today is called Abdul Allah Muhammad, he was the minister of Temple Number 27 in Los Angeles. And we're going to listen to Marvin Gaye's Ain't That Peculiar. This was a sermon that Minister John Shabazz used to talk about. You do me wrong, but still I'm crazy about you. Talking about the so-called American Negro. This is Marvin Gaye's Ain't That Peculiar.
About you. Stay away too long and I can't do without you. Every chance you get, you seem to hurt me more and more. But each hurt makes my love stronger than before. I know flowers grow to rain, but how can love go to pain? To make me blue, it's a doggone shame. My love for you makes all your lies seem true. But if the truth makes love last longer, why do lies make my love stronger?
To get my way. I know love can last 2 years, but how can love last 2 tears? I ain't got peculiar, baby.
Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio, and we're going to be speaking with Dara Maliki Obey shortly. But first, let's listen to Marvin Gaye's "Gotta Give It Up."
Oh,
sports reporters covering the New York Yankees than there are covering the entire continent of Africa.
And it's a shame when we as African people, we make up damn near the majority of the city, but we have to fight to get on white ruling class media.
That tells you something about the priorities of the news media in this country.
We are engaged in a war of ideas.
Warning.
You're locked in to Uhuru Radio.
Stand by.
Right here, right now.
APSP, UhuruRadio.com.
I and I no mix with the wicked men. I and I say trample the
Sankankaba.
Take a lele malokinika and a teridi.
Uhuru Radio was envisioned as a means by which our community, our people, our party, our revolutionary aspirations could contend with the ruling class in this war of ideas that contributes to maintaining the oppression of African people. Part of what African internationalism, Garveyism in the 21st century is about is ending that isolation, is bringing African people together in common struggle. And Uhuru Radio, it allows Africans in any place in the world to have access to other Africans so that reinforcing are always on the way, no matter where it is that we're struggling and no matter what may be the temporary setbacks.
Finally, the station you've been looking for.
Uhuru Radio. No degrading lyrics.
I never call you my bitch or even my boo. It's so much in the name and so much more than you.
Progressive.
And you love her up to us. So you buy her a diamond. If I want to die, oh, don't you think there's something wrong with it?
And millions of dollars leave Sierra Leone in the form of diamonds, yet the people who mine the diamonds make 30 cents a day and a cup of rice. That's the reality all over Africa.
And revolutionary.
AFDEF is an organization of the Uhuru movement that was built in 2007 in order to organize African doctors, nurses, scientists, engineers, and other skilled Africans around the world to coordinate a variety of development projects that work to transform the miserable conditions of existence that have been imposed on our people around the world.
APSP, UhuruRadio.com.
Uhuru Radio is developing a new programming schedule to include more music, cultural, educational, political, and multilingual programs from around the world. We are professionalizing the technical delivery of our programming, improving our sound quality and presentation. We are working to make our audio stream more accessible through mobile devices and distribution networks. This is your media, Uhuru News, Uhuru Radio, and the Burning Spear newspaper, the voice of the International African Revolution. We rely on your support to get the truth out about our struggle for freedom. Become a member today. Your donation of any amount will make a difference.
APSP, UhuruRadio.com.
You are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali. Speaking to you from Toronto, Canada, we were listening to Marvin Gaye's Got to Give It Up, and joining me on the line from somewhere in the world is Dar Malik El Bey. And how are you doing today, Dar?
I'm doing good, my brother. How are you?
I'm good. I guess for full disclosure, I guess you and I are almost diaper buddies. We've been knowing one another for many moons, I guess I can say.
Many moons. Yes, sir.
And I think you and I went to the same high school, junior high school. We used to sing in groups together, and we've done quite a bit together. But I wanted to get your thoughts on Blurred Lines, you know, and the whole controversy between the gay estate and Pharrell and Robin Thicke. I know when I was in California for a little while, I knew that African people it seems like in the United States are split over Robin Thicke. A lot of people love him to death, and a lot of people don't think too much of him. What do you think about the first question is, what do you think about the controversy, you know, about the song?
Well, I listened to both of them, and recently too. I mean, you know, within the last like probably 72 hours, I've listened to them, and I've been, you know, I've heard pretty much, you know, what the consensus is from everybody's point of, you know, from the point of view of both sides. And I mean, just listening to the song alone, you know, it took me, the first time I heard it, actually, back about 7-8 months ago, I guess, the first time I heard it, I thought it was Marvin Gaye's song, and I had to dial in. But when I was hearing a different vocal over the top, I had to really focus, because I thought it was Marvin Gaye. I thought I was listening to a tune from back in the day. So, my take on the judgment was that in that case, I would think that the judgment was I think it was a just decision. They gave Marvin's family $7 million. They probably owe him a lot more than that, but they gave him $7 million because the copyright laws are odd anyway in terms of how they cover the way they deal with
plagiarism. Plagiarism.
Yeah, plagiarism, copyright infringement, that sort of thing. Yeah. So the laws are strange anyway, and that's they're talking about blurred lines. There's some blurred lines there as well, but all of that said, I mean, you know, if you just listen to the tune and you heard the original, you listen to that, you just go basically, you know, well, like they took Marvin's tune, and not only did they take the tune, they really took the soul of the tune, because they took the groove, which is, you know, it's hard to define groove a lot of times, because that's musicians, and just the way they're, and what they're doing in the studio, you know, you can't really define that. It's just, when it happens, and when it doesn't, you know, in terms of groove. But when somebody's able to cop a groove like that, you know, I mean, the least they could have done was, I would have thought that they would, you know, I mean, there's no way that you can miss that. So I would have thought that they'd have been forthright about it at the beginning, but since they weren't, you know, they got taken to court. And I'm glad for Jan and the family, really. I'm glad for Jan. I'm glad for Nona. I'm glad for all of them. Frankie, you know, I'm glad that they got the settlement. They should have got more, in my opinion.
Well, let me ask you this. You started off as a singer, but, you know, in later years, you learned to play instruments, and you work with Sagidi Abdullah, who, you know, Sagidi Abdullah was, I guess, famous for Baby Take Your Time, Do It Right with the SOS band. Now, how many instruments can you play today?
I play about, I guess, let's see, keyboards, bass, drums, guitar, all the basic rhythm instruments. And then I play a little trumpet. I haven't had a trumpet for a while, so I haven't been practicing, but I have a trumpet as well. I'm actually learning to play trumpet. And, congas, bongos, you know, all the percussion stuff, so.
Okay, now I ask you that because you and I were together in 1978 and 1979. We were at the Los Angeles Coliseum, and they played the song Got to Give It Up, and there were 100,000 people in the stadium. And that particular song, James Brown, they played Too Funky near with James Brown. They got a nice applause. But 100,000 people stood up and gave Marvin Gaye's song a standing ovation. Could you talk about that particular, you know, what do you remember about that day?
Well, I do remember that. I think Chaka Khan had come on, and they did that. I think if I remember right, they did that before. They did that in the afternoon, or late in the afternoon,
yes.
Actually.
Right.
And so it was either just before or just after Chaka Khan left the stage, and I think it was between Chaka Khan and the Brothers Johnson, as well as I can remember. It's been a long time. But anyway,
On that particular show, you had Parliament Funkadelic, Bootsy's Rubber Band. The Astor Brothers couldn't come out because they didn't want to follow Bootsy. Bootsy would burn up the place.
Rufus Chaka Khan,
Brothers Johnson. Yeah, right.
Yeah. So early when they did that, when they did that thing for Marvin, I think it was probably somewhere between 5 and 6 in the evening, you know, maybe 6 and 7 in the evening, because I think it was summertime. So when they did it, I mean, you know, it hadn't been that long, you know, that song had come out. I can't remember the exact year now, but
70,
anyway,
it came out 77, 70, late 70s, yeah.
Late 70s, yeah, right around, not long before that festival, actually. So, right. Or just after, I can't remember. I think just before, though. Just before. Like, probably 76 or 77. But anyway.
No, it was after that, because I came, I remember I hadn't been in America for many years, and I came back in I hooked up with you, and I hooked up with Sagitti, and I remember that. And we, at that particular time, I think we met Jan, and we met Azizi Johari, and Norman Whitfield. We were backstage, and we met everybody, if I remember correctly.
I remember meeting Azizi and seeing Jan. Yeah, I already knew Jan, because I remember her from LACC. She was at LACC for a short time, my last stint there, and incredibly, she had a beautiful spirit, you know, so... I remember her from that. I mean, I don't think we ever actually spoke, but I remember her. I remember seeing her. Well, we did speak, but it would be like hi, going from class to class. But you know, there was no. I never knew her that well, but I remember that she had a beautiful spirit, and I remember that. I remember hearing that Marvin for the first time was really. You know, really smitten by a female, and he was really smitten by her. And so, you know, I mean, it was rough going for them for a lot of years because of his struggles. He was struggling with different things in his life. But anyway, so when they did that, there was a lot of, I'm saying that to say there was a lot of emotion around it because of what I knew of Marvin Gaye, you know, and his personal, some of his personal life, you know, I mean, some of that, you know, kind of stuck with me because it was a tumultuous time. He was going through a lot of stuff. And so.
Now you remember, we had a group at the time. We actually auditioned for Marvin Gaye and Harvey Fuqua. Now Janice Hunter became his wife, and LACC is Los Angeles City College. Yeah. So, what do you remember about the audition that we had with Marvin Gaye and Harvey Fuqua?
Listen, that was some funny. That was one. That was hilarious. We had a. I remember we put this group together, and we had had a group earlier when we were still in high school, and that was in, I think that was in '65 when we auditioned for him, or late '64, one or the other. It might have been like summer of '64. I can't remember. Summer of '64 or summer of '65. But anyway, right after we graduated, and. What had happened was that we didn't have a ride to the audition. Sagitti's mom hooked up the audition because her and Marvin were fairly close. And so she got us the audition. Sagitti calls us and tells us we got to put this thing together and do this thing, you know. And so we all had been rehearsing together, so we knew some tunes. And so we didn't have a ride. So there was a guy who used to sing with us when we were in high school named Bill Spiller, who became a lawyer. In fact, he ended up doing a lot of stuff with Janet Reno. But anyway, we called him because we didn't have a ride to the hotel up on Sunset. I think it was the Sunset, I remember the name of that hotel. Really nice hotel. They redid it in the last like 15 years, so it's back to, you know, pristine again. But anyway, we went, so we called Bill to get a ride. And so there were five of us in the group at the time, and me, you, Sagitti, Harold Clayton, Royce Jones, and was Royce with us? Royce was with us, right?
Royce was not. Royce wasn't there that day when we auditioned. No.
Okay, so it was me, you. It was me, you, Sagitti, Harold, and Dwayne Moore, but we needed a ride, so we called Bill and told him what the deal was, and Bill, you know, he only half-assed believed that we were actually going to audition for Marvin Gaye, so he took us, you know, reluctantly. We got some gas money together, gave him like, you know, $5 or something like that, whatever, 1964, 65.
Big money, right?
So he takes us up to the hotel. We get up to the room. We knock on the door. And, you know, like Bill is starting to get more excited now because he's realizing we're not, you know, we're not joking. So we get inside, we get in the room, and Bill's eyes get big. I'm still watching him see his eyes get big. And so Sagitti and Marvin talk for a minute because they know one another because of his mom. And then we, you know, all of us have a few seconds where, you know, we're talking to Marvin and Harvey Fuqua. And they had adjoining rooms, so, you know, Harvey came over to Marvin's room, and they were eating breakfast actually when we came through. And so anyway, so Marvin says, well, you know, so we tell him a little bit about ourselves and what we're trying to do and whatever, Marvin and Harvey say, well, let's see what you guys are doing. What do you got? And so we go into the first tune, and I look up, and Bill Spiller has now jumped into the group. So now there's a six-member group. You know what I'm saying? So I look up and I go, well, you know, there's nothing we can do now. So I fade that on out, and we just go through the routines. Bill remembers some of the routines, so some of them were, you know, to a song I think we had done. We did some stuff that everybody knew. He knew too, actually. So he didn't kill us on the routine, but that was comedy. And so and Marvin and Harvey were sitting there watching.
Since I Lost My Baby and It's Growing and Golden Girl, I think was the songs we sang.
Since I Lost My Baby and It's Growing.
Yeah.
I think so. And so anyway, so Marvin and Harvey noticed, you know, they kind of noticed when Bill jumped in the group, and they kind of, you know, looked at each other. But anyway, we went through the songs, you know, they said, nice fellas, and blah, 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 this, that, and the other. You know, Marvin basically said, you know, I'll give your mom a call and let her know what's happening, blah, blah. And so, you know, I mean, obviously we weren't ready to be a Motown act at the time, because we had patterned ourselves, you know, basically on acts that they already had, you know, on the label. That we were so young, you know, we didn't know. So, you know, we tried to pull something off. But anyway, it was a fun, you know, great to meet those guys. I really like Harvey Fuqua a lot. Great, a great person. You know, and a great mentor at Motown, actually. So it was a great experience for me. And Marvin, too, I mean, I liked him a lot as well. I thought he was, like, the greatest dude in the game. I always thought he was a football player. He always looked like, you know, a running back to me. And even the first time I saw him way back, I thought he was a running back. And then I found out that he had gone out for, gone to try and play for one of the pro teams, and got out there and realized.
I think it was the Detroit Lions, right?
Yeah, it might have been the Detroit. Yeah, it was the Detroit Lions. Yeah, so he went out for the Detroit Lions, and you know, basically he realized that wasn't what he wanted to do, because those guys out there, you know, that was like meat and potatoes for, you know, for the fam. So everybody out there was hitting really hard, and so Marvin jumped out of that real quick. But yeah, man, so that was a great day, a real great experience, funny. And, you know, I'll never forget it.
Hi, you're listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. I'm speaking with Dar Malik L. Bay and Marvin Gaye. I think we had another experience with Marvin Gaye when we went to a party with Sagitti's mother. What do you remember about that situation?
You know, I don't remember much about that. Was Marvin at that party?
Marvin wasn't at that party. Minister John Shabazz, Abdul Allah.
John Shabazz.
Yeah,
yeah.
Minister. Let's just leave it the fact that he was at the party. And let's just leave that one alone. But yeah. We had a lot of dealings with a lot of people at that particular time. Now, you guys, did you talk about, you know, what happened, you know, when I left you guys, Harold was, I guess, killed in an automobile accident. And, could you talk about, you know, the career you had with Sagitti Abdullah and Harold Clayton? And you said, what did you guys do?
Well, not long after high school, I met Harold and Sagidi. I met Sagidi first. I met Sagidi at a Temptation show that was at the 5-4 Ballroom. There was a ballroom in L.A. called the 5-4 Ballroom, and there was a guy who used to book the West Coast and black acts for the West Coast, chilling circuit, so to speak, because 5-4 Ballroom was on the chilling circuit for sure. Anyway, Dolphins of Hollywood, all of that. But anyway, Dolphins of Hollywood was a record shop. But anyway, so we met at this show, and another friend of ours, a brother named Ed Skaggs, who was also a vocalist, who was just out of high school as well. He actually introduced myself and Sagidi. He met Sagidi first, and when I came in, I thought Sagidi was with Motown because he was actually taller than everybody in the Temptations, and those guys are tall. So Sagidi was like 6'4", and I think Eddie and Otis and David were all, you know, between 6'3" and 6'4". I think Eddie and Sagidi might have been almost the same height. Sagidi ended up being about 6'5". But anyway, so I thought he was part of the group, you know, I didn't know. And so we ended up meeting there and talking about the show afterwards, and then we started talking about, you know, we should put a group together and blah blah blah. And so we finally did that, and there's an area called Baldwin Hills. We pulled some musicians up out of Baldwin Hills that we knew and started practicing. There was a couple other guys who were writing tunes, a guy named Nate Fortell and a couple of other people that we knew that were, you know, fledgling songwriters. So we had material, we had a lot of guidance, and we met some other people along the way who had heard us do different auditions at different places, like the California Club and places. And in fact, that's where I first saw Jimi Hendrix, was at the California Club. We wanted to do an audition for a gig there, and Jimi Hendrix came through with Little Richard. And I knew Little Richard had a pompadour, but Jimi Hendrix came through and had a pompadour, hired Little Richard. And I found out later that Little Richard was mad about that because he didn't want nobody in the band to have a bigger pompadour. But anyway... So that's kind of how we met. That's kind of how we started. We did all the, you know, stuff around town. We started opening shows at the 5-4 Ballroom. We started opening shows at the California Club. And so we were in it in terms of Chitlin' Circuit R&B back in the day. We were like in Chitlin' Circuit heaven, but, you know, only on the West Coast. But,
that's kind of comical because I remember I was at the 5-4 Ballroom that night. There's one thing that I never will forget as long as I live. Paul Williams was standing there, and somebody called him, "Hey, Smut."
Oh, yeah, that was Eddie LaVert.
Smut's nickname, Paul Williams' nickname was Smut because he was so dark. And I never will forget Paul Williams says, "Your mama."
Your mama.
and everybody just bust out laughing.
Bust out of laughing, and that was right in the middle of "If It's Love That You're Running From."
yes, right, because he closed the show with that show.
Eddie LaVert yells out, "Sing it, Smut!" I'm talking about Eddie LaVert from the OJs. "Sing it, Smut!"
Right.
Paul goes, "Your mama, there's no hiding place." Kick right into you. Beautiful. that happened. That happened, man. That was funny. So you and I mean, we all got our inspiration from that. You went on and with Pat and Willie.
Eminem and the Peanuts,
yep. And we went another direction with this band. I think you were already with Eminem and the Peanuts in high school, weren't you?
I was with the Perennials in high school. That was with... Frank Tina Felico, who was his brother was married Tina Turner's sister. He was with Ron Felico, played with he played on Sam Cooke's on "Don't Know Much About History." Boom, 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 yeah. And Ron, we had the Perennials. We had Pee Wee, Frank Harrison, Charles Brinkley, and Pee Wee Faulkner. Yeah, we were the perennials. We had recorded, I think I was 16, something like that. Yeah, I think I was the first one in the neighborhood that recorded a record. Yeah, right.
Yeah, I remember that. I remember you had a group in high school for sure. So anyway, we kind of broke off and we were doing our thing, man. And then we kind of moved from there into the, I went into the military. We kind of split up for a minute. When I came out of the military, we got back together, myself, Sagitti, and Harold, and Eric, who's the nucleus of that group. And we started a group based on a whole different genre of music. So we were like the first black kids in our neighborhood to be, dressed like hippies, doing all the other things that hippies did and playing all the clubs around, and hanging out on Sunset Strip on Friday and Saturday nights, which was, a blast. And so, we brought all that back into the hood where brothers and sisters weren't really, everybody there was kind of on some nationalism, wearing naturals and all that. And they hadn't really seen anybody like us. And we had this band called Conjur, Conjur, because we were influenced by Dr. John, who was Mac Rabinac, who was a voodoo priest from New Orleans, and we were impressed by him and Hendrix and Creedence Clearwater and the Chambers Brothers. So, we got into that, and so that's what we were doing all through the 60s. And then when that kind of faded out, Sagitti ended up, looking for a gig as a writer. He couldn't really find one, so he took a gig as a copyist at Motown. And so he was in steady contact with Marvin and, Eddie and David and Melvin from the Temptations. And also Levi used to hang out there a lot, too. This is when Motown had moved from Detroit to L.A. Unannounced, pretty much, except for a note on the door at Hitsville in Detroit. It left a note on the door, we're out, and that was pretty much it. But so anybody who had the dough to follow them out, followed them out, but it made it rough for a lot of people. In fact, that caused a big rift in Motown itself. Are you there? Hello?
I'm speaking with Dar Malik El-Bey, and we have about 1 minute left. We lost you, but we got you back. And Sagitti went on to do his thing with Motown. That's what you're getting ready to say, right?
Yeah, Sagitti went on to Motown, became a copyist there. And so basically what he did from that point was he made a lot of contacts, and he stayed in contact with, most of the guys in the Temptations and Marvin and... because a lot of the Stevie, all those guys used to come. They used to hang out at the office when they moved to L.A. and hang out at the studio, actually. And so we started there dealing with the backside of the business and going more into writing and production stuff like that. To make a long story short, he ended up getting the deal with Clarence Avon over at Taboo to produce the SOS band, and I came in with him to work on that. So over a period from like 1965 to 19 probably 80-81, we stayed in steady contact and we're working together, as you know, in the music business.
All right, so we'll have to bring you back and thank you for this information, and we will definitely talk to you again. And it was nice talking to you, and nice reconnecting, and some good history.
Yes, sir. Same here, my brother.
All right, and we have been speaking with Malik LB, and I would like to thank Lisa Watson for technical knowledge today, and we will see you in the whirlwind. We will be back when we will be back, and we will see you soon. Take care.
Shocking pyramids was built.